தெருவன் சரணை. நோ ஆக்சுவலி ரியலி தெருவன் சரணை. யூனோ ஐ வாஸ் ஜஸ்ட் திங்கிங் டு மை செல்ஃப் ஆஸ் ஐ வாஸ் வாக்கிங் இன் டு திஸ் ரூம், ஐ ஹாவ் த பெஸ்ட் ஜாப் இன் த வேர்ல்ட் as well as the easiest job in the world. As I was worshiping the Buddha, laying down flowers at his feet, I was thinking to myself, all I have to say is the truth. What can be easier than speaking the truth? Because when you have to speak things other than the truth, now you have to come up with all sorts of convincing arguments. And then to convince one person of a lie, you need 100 more, don't you? Because a lie cannot stand up by itself. Thank you. Sadhukarya then. You know the story behind that? Yes. I'm trying to be careful since then. I've been told off. When you say sadhukarya, then be very specific. There is not sadhukarya, sadhukarya. I'll tell you the story behind this in a moment. But I was just so pleased and just so, you know, I feel so relaxed. Never felt this relaxed and just as at ease, because all I have to speak is the truth. It's not like I have to come up with all sorts of arguments and counter arguments, and because, you know, when you say a lie, you have to fight for it, you have to come up with 100 more to defend it, but when you have to speak the truth, all you have to do is speak the truth, because the truth is self-sustaining. It's self-standing, isn't it? So that's why I say, I have the best job in the world. Do you want it? Then come and get it. Right. Good to see all these lovely faces. You want a piece of the truth. That's why you're all here today. Then without further ado, let's get started. So before we commence then, let us all take a moment to pay homage to the glorious one, the undefeated one, the unparalleled one, the magnificent one. He was self-awakened and fully awakened to the truth, self-enlightened, and then with out of boundless compassion and an infinite amount of loving kindness, shared his wisdom with all of us, and for many more generations to come, we will forever be his students, his disciples, until the very end. With that in mind, and with that as a pledge we take upon ourselves, we bring our palms together in veneration of his holy name, the supremely enlightened Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. நமோ தஸ்ஸ பகவதோ அர்ஹதோ சம்மா சம்புத்தஸ்ஸ.
யங் மைண்ட்ஸ், தே ஆர் ஹைலி இம்ப்ரெஷனபிள், எக்ஸ்ட்ரீம்லி சோ மச் சோ தட் யூ கேன் கன்சிடர் யங் மைண்ட்ஸ், த யங் மைண்ட்ஸ் தட் லிவ் around you and with you, they are your mirror. They mirror your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings. That is why when we talk with you, always encourage you and invite you to think about the impact that your influence has on the young minds around you. Your children, of course, other children, just children in general. This is a great example of that. Some weeks ago, someone who comes to the English sermons at Rajagiriya and used to come to the sermons at the monastery as well, so a regular, someone among you, perhaps to this day you don't know who it is because it's not the name that we're interested in. It's not who is good, it's just good. Wholesomeness does not belong to anybody. Goodness does not belong to anybody. So good is good. So someone in the audience, one someone among you, wanted to make an offering to the Sambuddha Sasana. So having contemplated whether they really wanted to do it, and having, of course, you know, when you make an offering of that size, of those proportions, you consult your family, your friends, and in the end, perhaps even despite obstacles and maybe even despite dissenting voices, in the end they decided that they were going to make the offering. And someone offered a car to the Sambuddha Sasana. Many of you were there that day. And if you remember, the lady who made the offering wanted me to share the story with you, but with no mention of who it was, wanted me to share the story with you so that you could all rejoice in it. Those of you who were present here will remember the event. It was only maybe one or two months ago. Young minds are highly impressionable. So in the audience was this young boy who observed this offering. So this young boy observed this offering, and reminiscent of how this man who observed the offering of the Jetavanarama in the Buddha's time, with their palms together, gave a sadhukara at the offering of the Jetavanarama, and then accrued even more merits than Anathapindika, who offered the Jetavanarama, reminding us of that great event. This young boy on that day had made a resolve that one day I shall make a similar offering. These are the thoughts that flashed through his mind in that moment. He was in the audience. So from that day on, he'd started building. So this was not made overnight. It's a masterpiece. On that day, he started building this. He started crafting this. His toy box. So he started collecting the cardboard for it. Then he started collecting the materials for it. He must have asked perhaps help from his parents, maybe his friends, maybe his siblings to help him support with this or to get support with this. And he must have gone out and found a design for it. And then piece by piece, he started building this car. The car that he wanted to offer to the Mahasangha, to the Buddha Sasana. This is not just any old car. This is a very special car. You must not think for one moment that the amount of merits that this young boy acquired by making this offering is any less than the merits that were acquired by the person who offered the real car. Because merit is not in the object. This is not metal. If I drop this, it will probably break into pieces. But merits is not in the object. It's in the volition. It's in the thought. It's in the intention. Look at this masterpiece. It even comes with its own manual. You must be so utterly impressed by this. It's very elaborate. You're probably wondering what these things are. It's in the manual. So I took this and I opened the hatch, and then I realized it's got two rubber bands in it as well. And then I thought, maybe by mistake. But then I read the manual. I was too hasty, I soon realized. So let me read the manual to you. The scroll. Use a manual. It has its own make and model. It's the 003 version of the NTH Akren 7 EV, so electric powered vehicle. And it comes in orange. Clearly orange because it was offered to the Mahasangha. It has to be. What other color would fit? The front and back dickies. Here's the front dicky and here's the back dicky. These instructions. There are rubber bands available if they don't close properly. Full option. Ladies and gentlemen, just think about the love, the attention, and the care that has gone into making this. You know, piece by piece, this thing would have come together. Not overnight. Day by day, night by night, week by week. This was a making, perhaps, you know, over several months. Well, the day that the car was offered was when the boy first had the idea. The thought occurred to him that I want one day to offer something similar. And then from that day on, it's been about a month, maybe 2 months. Right? Since then, he's been piecing this together. There's storage in the front and back dickies, and this is a 7-seater. In case you're not sure, let me show you. So there are 2 seats at the front. Then there are 3 seats at the back. And there's another seat row at the rear. Okay? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This is electricity powered. It has an LED light bar on the front and back. So in case you were wondering what they are the LEDs. So it can light the way up as it travels. And also when you go in reverse, you also have LEDs. So you're probably wondering, how do I get to the back seats? Don't fear, there are instructions. Reclinable second row seats. They have been made so that they are reclinable. Can use as a bed. So when the car was offered to Swami Nuhanse, the boy said, Swami Nuhanse, when you're tired after a sermon, or if you're tired having gone for Pindapatha, right? And you're tired and you want to head back, this Anagarika Mahatya can drive. You can rest, Swami Nuhanse. So the seats are reclinable. Talk about traveling in first class. It's a 4-door vehicle. It's all here. To get to the last row, put down the second row of seats. It's all in the book. Just think about again the love, the attention, the meticulousness that's gone into piecing this together. Each of those thoughts that would have contributed to making this, folks, you know, is a fountain of merit. Each of those thoughts, because each thought has the power to generate merits. The children that you're surrounded by, are impressed by your actions, your deeds, and your thoughts. Where did this boy get this idea from? From being among you. It was not his mother on that day who made the offering. It was not his aunt. It was not his grandmother. It was just someone in the audience, some random person. But do you see how impressed he was by that action? To think that one day he is going to offer this. And then when the boy came and offered this, he told me, Swaminathan said, when I grow up, here's a bit he got wrong. He said, when I grow up, I'm going to go do a job, earn myself enough money, and then I'm going to buy a car just like this, and I'm going to offer it to the Mahasangha. That's the bit he got wrong, because although he thinks he's going to be doing all that, not under my watch. I've got other plans for him. Because a young man of that caliber deserves better than that. All will come when the time is right. No rush, no haste. But, you know, when you observe a young man, a young child, and their actions right at their roots, you can tell how this tree is going to grow one day, right? So, I think that is just wishful thinking. He has already made the offering. The amount of merits are the same as if he had offered a real car. So the car has already been offered. There's a palace to his name in the heavens. Unfortunately, he's never going to be going there. If I have it my way. See, I just want to share this with you so you know how impressed young children are by your actions. This is why I say worship your parents. Honor your parents. If your children are to do the same, then you've got to be a role model. You've got to set the example. You've got to set the bar right. Because it is in your footsteps they will follow. You know, children are not the kind who do what they're supposed to do. I think you can well and truly agree with that. Children are not the kind who do what they're supposed to do. Children are the kind who do what they want to do. When you were younger, which made you happier? Getting into your shoes or getting into your mother's or your father's? Remember getting into your dad's shoes and walking around? Or your mother's stilettos and walking around in them? Pretending to be a grown-up girl? Pretending to be a grown-up woman? Pretending to be a grown-up man? Remember? And carrying his briefcase, your father's, in your hand and walking around? I used to go to work when I was only 2. Or at least I thought I was. Because we always want to be like grown-ups. You recall this from your own childhood. When we saw our fathers getting into the car, you know, settling themselves down at the front wheel and holding it in their hands, you know, and shifting the gear, touching the levers, you know, riding around in their vehicles, you know, we wanted to do the same. So when they were not watching, what did we used to do as young kids? You know, we'd go and sneak into the car, try and get ourselves into it, and then go broom, 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 broom. Remember? And we used to have these playhouses, we used to have play cars, and pretend that we were grown up, because that's what we like to do. We don't do what we're supposed to do, we do what we like to do. See, the same manner. Kids, they're supposed to be doing their homework. They're supposed to be doing what kids do. Kids don't do this sort of thing. Kids don't make offerings to the Mahasangha, but what they do is what they see their parents doing. They do what they see adults doing. They do what they see teachers doing. That's why your actions should be well discerned. They should be well thought through. Because if you're being watched, which you always are, your children are always watching you. You leave an imprint on their mind, an indelible print that you cannot sometimes reverse. So both good and bad, that's the other side of the coin. Both good and bad. Many people, if you investigate why they've taken up drinking, smoking, if you look back into their past, they were influenced by the adults that surrounded them. Perhaps they grew up in that sort of environment. If you take young children and wonder why they're so aggravated all the time, so angry all the time, chances are that's the environment in which they grew up. If you find young children who, as you know, after they've grown up, they don't show much kindness and affection to others, then perhaps that's the, not perhaps, actually, that is more like the environment in which they grew up. They were not shown kindness. They were not shown generosity. They were not shown charity. Oftentimes, when we speak to people who have been convicted of child molestation, you find out their history. They've been molested as young children. So the experiences that they've had as young children, you know, the experiences stay with them. The print that it makes on their mind, that stays with them. The influences that you have on them, that stay with them. That is why it's very important for us to be mindful of the ways in which we conduct ourselves in and around young children. And this is a perfect example of that. I recall that day when the car was offered, I invited all of you to rejoice in those merits by offering a sadhukar. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, a car has been offered to the sasana. Let us all rejoice with the sadhukar. Sad, sad, sad. In your hearts, I want you to make blessings. Give those and pass those blessings to that child, as well as all those who have helped and supported that child to engage in this meritable deed. And I see that face every day. He comes along, young child, but comes along regularly. That's why I always, you know, say kudos to the parents who make it a point to bring their children. If they can understand what is being said, if they can understand the language, and if they've got nothing much more important to do on a Sunday morning, bring them along. If we have enough children here, one day we can start another program parallel to this. I think in the first couple of weeks, some parents came and asked, and I said, you know, give your names. If we have enough children to start a program, we can run one parallel to this, so the adults can be here, the children can be in another room. I'm sure the management of the school will be happy to accommodate that. Goodness. We need more goodness in this world, don't we? You know all the evil that's going on. Our people are fighting with each other and tearing down civilization. You know all that's going on out there. So we need more goodness. If this world is to exist, folks, you know, the goodness have to be more than the badness. That is the way in which this world will survive. So we must all collectively be good and be doing good to counter all the terrible things that are going on in this world. Because evil only leads to destruction. You need good to counter that. And the way the world works is there is always going to be evil, but there's always going to be good. For as long as there's more good than evil, this world will survive. This planet, this earth that as we know it, will survive until then. But the day that comes where there is more evil than good, when that day comes, and that day will come, it is inevitable. All things that arise will one day perish. Mankind as a race will perish. We will. But that day will come when there is more evil than good. Because evilness only begets evilness. and it only leads to destruction. And one day there will not be enough good people in and amongst us to sustain humanity as a race. And then people will just keep on killing each other, murdering each other, genocide at their will and whim. And then that will spell the end of mankind. That day will come. It will certainly come. But we can delay that as much as we possibly can by doing good. Why do we want to delay this? Because we still have the Buddha Sasana. We can make use of our human life. We can make use of our human intuition. We can make use of our human intelligence. We can make use of the teaching. Be the change you want to see in this world, said Mahatma Gandhi once. So if we want goodness in this world, then who do we start with? Certainly with ourselves. And start it at home, which you all have. Otherwise, these things would just be a fantasy. But it is becoming a reality. So it gives me great joy, really, to see young children engage in such meritable deeds. And the fact that their minds are inclined to do good and great things like this, because, as I said, they are a mirror of their parents, of the adults that surround them, of their elder sisters, their elder brothers, and so on. So when you see a child do a good deed, you can be assured that there is also someone behind them who is encouraging them, teaching them, guiding them, and inspiring them to be good, to be great. Are you all not grateful for your parents? And to your parents, for all the good and great things you have been able to achieve today? Don't you all, sing praises about what your parents did for you? Were they not the guiding light that stood behind you? Your parents and your teachers? I always talk about them. I can speak about them, till the end of this sermon and more. Because I know that where I am today is a result of what they did for me. So in the same way, when you see young children do such wonderful things, you can be assured that there's a guiding light behind them. And that impresses me even more. It's all of you, by the way. Because it takes a whole village to raise a child. A nice proverb. It takes a whole village to raise a child. This is that village. The child comes here. I'm talking, speaking on behalf of all children. They come here. They sit in, amongst you. They see how you greet each other. All of this they are influenced by. When I walk in, excuse me, when we walk into the school, there are young children waiting down there with the mutukuda, waiting to hold it up and walk Swami Nuhanse into the Dhamma hall, into the lift. And you see how eager they are to do this. Now, this is not Vihara Mahadevi Park where young men are eager to hold an umbrella for their loved ones. Young boys, 6, 7, 8, 9, at such a young age, they're eager to hold the mudukuta for a Swami Nuhanse, inviting the Swami Nuhanse to deliver a sermon, to deliver the truth, to deliver freedom. You have no idea how much merit they earn by doing so. And where do you think they've learned this from? I didn't walk in here with a mutukuda. Who do they learn these things from? From you. And when you wash the Swami Nuhanse's feet with love and respect and devotion, children are stood there watching that, all that. When you offer the Pindapatha, young children are stood there watching that. They learn. When you're walking down the street and you see a poor man, right, and you can extend your generosity and offer him something. Doesn't have to be money. If you have some spare food and you offer that to him, there's children at the back of the car watching you. They'll ask you, Appachi, Tati, Dad, what was that? Why did you do that? That gets them started. And then you give them a story. We have to be good, Buddha. Because what you give is what you get. Those people, they're so misfortunate because they never had someone in their lives to teach them that lesson. Therefore, they never gave. Therefore, they don't have. But I never want you to be like that one day. I want you to learn what Appaji just did. I want you to learn what Dad just did. See what Tati did? He gave. So he'll never be without. He will always be with. And whether we get or not, immaterial actually. We give because we have. We give because we can. It puts a smile on another person's face, so why not? Someone bumps into you, it's their mistake, and you say sorry. Your kid is going to ask you why. Don't you think so? In the same manner that when you bump into someone and you don't say sorry, they'll learn. That's why it's terrible. And sometimes adults at home, you know, they have fights. Sometimes they swear in front of their children. Mothers, fathers, never tell the other one off in front of your children. It's a terrible thing to do. One of the worst things you could do. Because the anger and resentment, it starts to grow in their minds. You go, you know, a child's mind is fertile soil. It's very fertile ground. That's why they're highly impressionable. So if ever you, as the father of the child, have something you want to say about the child's mother, something that you know that the child is not supposed to hear. You know, you have your own arguments at home. That's fine, you know, domestic arguments, it happens all the time. C'est la vie, huh? That's the way life works. Good times and bad times. The full moon is always brighter after a heavy rain, is it not? What is love if you don't get a chance to have a brawl once in a while? Okay, if you say so. My only ask is, please don't do it in front of your children. Because to a child, his mother should be holy, sacred. In the manner you never tell the Buddha off in front of your children. You don't do that. You don't do that. To the child, their mother is holy, sacred, sacrosanct. To the child, its father is sacred. Remember, it's not the same as when you, if you were to, you know, for whatever reason, hit your wife, it's not the same when the child hits the mother. But if you keep on that behavior at home, and you keep saying things, if you keep foul-mouthing either the mother or the father of the child, and the child grows up watching this, and if they think that is the way to treat someone, if they don't agree with what I have to say, that is the way to correct them when they don't agree with what I have to say. That is the way to treat someone if they speak up and disagree with what I have to say, then they will learn from you, folks. And one day they will raise their arm against their mother. That slap is not the same slap that you gave her. It's a very different slap. Makes the same sound, makes the same noise, leaves the same mark on her face. But the mark it leaves on their soul is destroying. That cannot be fixed for a very long time. And the mother's the same. You will have problems with your husbands. Yeah, it's difficult. But never speak against him. Don't talk him down. Don't belittle him. Don't undermine him in front of your children. I'm not suggesting that you do. I'm just saying in case the circumstances present themselves in future one day, I'm just giving you the skill to handle yourselves in those situations, particularly if your children are at home. If you really want to have a fight, let's say you have a fight every poya day, just to get it out of your system. Just for the kicks, that's how you get your kicks. Let's just say you have one every fortnight. Right? Maybe find somewhere to send the child. Ask him to go be with his friends or something. Or ask him to go fly a kite. You come, you have your fight, and then when you are done, right, after the mother is done crying, after the father is done throwing things on the floor and smashing things, sweep the house, get rid of all the broken cutlery, the broken dishes and whatever, right? And the mother, go wash your face, right? Prim yourself up, and then get the child back. And when the child walks back in, just pretend that nothing ever happened. You've had your fight, but the child is none the wiser. Never do it in front of the children. Because I'm not just talking about the influence or the mark it leaves on them for that lifetime. I'm talking about what's going to happen to them afterwards. And besides, you know, when they grow up and they go on to become spouses, they will learn that is how they have to treat their spouses in the event that there's a disagreement. A lot of the time, you know, when you see people, they have fights at home and they use violence at home, if you look back into their past, chances are that is what they learnt growing up at home. Because young minds are highly impressionable. Never be that person, because that you will regret. The day you get to hear that your son has hit his wife so hard that she had to be hospitalized, and then you're the one who has to take the flowers to go see the daughter-in-law, that day you will hold her hand and you will ask her, "Dua, what's up? What happened?" She'll start sobbing and she'll say, "Speak to your son." And then you go ask him, "What happened? What did you do that for, puta?" "Tati, that's what you taught me at home. I remember when you had problems with Ammi, you just slapped her left, right and center. That's how I learned. To teach her a lesson. So I learned that lesson and now I'm teaching her that lesson." What if you also have grandchildren by that point? Don't start things you can't stop. Especially if you want to stop them. Don't start things you can't stop. Sansara is okay to start because you can stop it. I'll show you how. But don't start bad habits at home. Anyway, that is not what I wanted to talk to you about today. But all that was courtesy of this car, of this offering. So all due credit goes to the creator of that. What did we talk about last week? I gave you some homework to do. Did you remember? You did? Oh, good. Give me a virtual show of hands if you forgot to do your homework. Only a virtual one. Ah, no hands up. Oh, good. Excellent. See, I know you don't want to disappoint me, do you? No, of course not. So I'm sure you all did your homework. What was the homework again? 5 things. 5 situations, 5 events in which you experience pleasure. The task I asked you to do was have a think about how pleasure happens. When you see beauty in sight, when you see beauty in sound, when you see beauty in taste, smell and touch, have a think about what the origins of this beauty is or are. That was the homework. What have you discovered about it then? Because I want this to be your own experiment in your lab of life. I can give you the theory, but it only becomes a reality for you once you start internalizing it and you start applying it in your own life. That's when it becomes a conviction. Until then it is faith. Bhakti and Shraddha are very different things. In the Buddha Sasana, we have Shraddha, not Bhakti. You have a Bhakti Gita. What is a Shraddha Gita? I sing the Shraddha Gita. See? Shraddha is conviction. Meaning something you have realized is true for yourself. Faith is something you take at face value because someone says so and you think they speak, you consider them to be an authoritative figure. Maybe you consider them to be speaking the truth. Right? You think they must know what they're talking about, so therefore I will accept it. It's like when we were younger, your parents used to say, don't put your finger in the fire. You took it by faith. Or sometimes they say, puta, that is kaki. Kaki puta, don't put your finger in the fire. It's funny, like sometimes, you know, parents teach the children the knife is kaki. Right? And then they go to school. And then the teacher asks, what have you brought for lunch today? And then the child says, I brought kaki sandwiches. And the teacher asks, how come? Well, because I saw my mother applying kaki on the bread with the bread knife. So that is faith, because someone says so. That's not what we need. You can't become a sotapanna out of faith. Becoming a sotapanna is the moment where the Dhamma is planted in your own mind and then it starts to shoot, starts to grow from there on. Once it takes root, that's it, it can no longer be uprooted. That is the becoming of a sotapanna. Conviction happens within you. And when that happens within you, ladies and gentlemen, there is not a soul in this world that can convince you otherwise. Your conviction in the Buddha, your conviction in the Dhamma, and your conviction in the Sangha, not the conventional Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. We've spoken about this in the past. Buddha is Nibbana. Dhamma is the path to Nibbana. And Sangha is the practice that takes you to Nibbana. Once you have seen the light at the end of the tunnel, at least if you've had a glimpse of it, now you know that there was light there. What you have seen cannot be unseen. That is the becoming of a sotapanna. To put it in very simple terms, it's the moment you realize that happiness can only be attained within oneself. It is not a product. It is not conditional. It's not a product of your experiences with other things or other people or other events. So for as long as you seek your happiness, for as long as you seek your internal joy through the association of other things, and you think internally, you actually believe that this happiness comes from the external objects, you can be well assured that you have not yet attained sotapanna, the state of sotapanna. A sotapanna may, from time to time, seek pleasures from the outside world, of course, because we are not speaking of an arahant, we are speaking of a sotapanna. A sotapanna will seek pleasures from the outside, but they know that this is a futile task. They experience the pleasure, but they know that this pleasure is based in delusion. They know it. It's a bit like this. Nowadays in homes they have these things called rain showers, don't they? They have those massive showers, you can get under them, and it gives you the impression that you're having a shower in the rain. Yeah. And you know the bathroom is also constructed in such a way, it's very natural. Huh? It's glass, and you have some pebbles and rocks and some greenery, and it just gives you the impression that you're with nature and it's raining. But you know well and truly that this is not real rain. You know that this is tube water. Yeah? So although you enjoy it and it gives you these moments of bliss, you know that this bliss is purely fictional. It's based in a lie. You know this. That is like the understanding of a sotapanna. They experience pleasure, but they know that this pleasure is a fallacy. What I'm hoping to do is to get you there first. I want you to fall out of love with pleasure. It's like when you have to be with someone and you know that they're cheating on you. Ever had that experience? Don't nod. Certainly don't nod this way. There are some questions for which you have to give me virtual answers, okay? And here's one of those questions. Ever had that experience where you're with someone, right, And they're coming up and giving you all this flowery talk, honey, bunny, and all that lovely talk, but you know that they're a big fat liar. You caught them, they just don't know it yet. You saw the text messages, you saw the photos, you saw the comments, right? They've been caught, but they don't know that yet. So you pretend that nothing's going on, but you have fallen out of love with them now, haven't you? You fell in love with them when you thought that they were the real deal, and now you have fallen out of love with them when you realize that they're just a cheat. What I want you to do, first and foremost, ladies and gentlemen, is to realize that pleasure is a cheat. That is what I want you to do first. Pleasure is a cheat. It's like a friend or an enemy in disguise. It comes like a friend. It gives you a hug, it gives you an embrace, but it's got a dagger in its hand. And the hand goes behind your back, and then it stabs you. But from the back, you don't see it. But you feel hurt. You feel the pain. But you look in front of you, and you know, it's only your friend. Or at least you think so. But they just stabbed you. Pleasure is the same. I'm giving you multiple analogies to help you figure out what I'm talking about here. Beauty is a cheat. That's why I say Beauty and the Beast. It is truly a beast, but taking the appearance of beauty. Let's try and get our heads around this concept. Because if you fall out of love with pleasure, then the remainder of this journey is going to be just a walk in the park. Honestly. Is it easier to get a divorce when you're in love with the person or when you realize that she's just a cheat? I keep saying he or she, you know, it works both ways, as you know. Right? So, he's a cheat. But, you know, do you remember when you had your first crush? Like long time ago. And then your parents found out about it, perhaps. But, you know, it was not up to their liking. It didn't tick their boxes, although it ticked plenty of yours. It didn't tick their boxes, and they said, nah, not him. Not under my watch, Dua. He's not the guy you're going to be going out with. I want you to stop that immediately. Remember that, ladies? You're younger, your father used to say. I want you to stop that immediately. And then you had a story to tell. But Tati, he's a nice guy. Now Tati knows everything. Tati knows that he's a cheat. Tati knows his story. But this girl wouldn't believe what the father has to say. Because she's head over heels. She's prejudiced. There's a thing called the Satara Agati in Buddhist teaching. These are the four prejudices. Chanda, Dosa, Baya and Moha. We'll speak about them on one of these days. There was a talk done at the monastery. These are the four prejudices. When you are prejudiced, you don't see fact. You can't rationalize. You don't see logic. You only see what your heart wants to see. Your brain shuts down. Never had those moments? Of course. When you know that what you have to do is one, but your heart wants to do the complete opposite of that, you're prejudiced. In business circles, they'll call it unconscious biases and so on. But remember that time when your father came and told you, no, you're not going out with him. He's not the type that I want you to be friends with, let alone have an affair with. So I need you to stop that right now. And then you said, no, but Tati, he's a guy, he's a nice guy, he's very kind, he says all these nice things about you even. He says he wants to be like you one day, Tati. Now you're trying to convince your father that he's the kind of guy that you should be going out with. See, now the father can do whatever he wants, whatever he'll try to do all sorts of things. Like he might even punish the girls. He said, right, you're you know, you're banned from going out. Give me a phone. Phone gets confiscated. Right? The number gets deleted. Right? No more texting. No more calling. No more messaging. No more internet. No more messenger. Right? All that has to stop. And I'm going to now take you to tuition class. I'm going to stay there until you're done. And I'm going to collect you and bring you back home. Thati. You know the drill. Why do you make my life so miserable? You'll ask him. But he knows what's right for you and what's wrong for you, because he's been there, done that. He's got plenty more years under his belt than you. He knows what's right for you. But, you know, as children, we never feel that way. We always think we know better than our parents, don't we? Only later do we realize how wrong we were. That is called maturing. Unfortunately, maturity doesn't come when we need it. It only comes when we don't need it. It's like the Sri Lankan buses. So when you know when advice is given, advice is always given when it's least heeded. Advice is always needed when it's least heeded. Agreed or not? Advice is most needed when it is least heeded. When you need it the most is when you listen to it the least. But that is the way it is. So in those moments, your father would have tried to do all sorts of things to try and, you know, break you up in that relationship, say, you know, give you punishments, ban you from doing stuff, but none of those things will work. Secretively, you will carry on that relationship. Sometimes you'll, you know, those, right, those, what do you call them, chits, in tuition class, right, you'll pass it along to that boy, send it to that boy, send it to that girl, and so on. Right, furtive glances. And in those, you know, in those moments of just one or two glances, you can share a whole love story. And, you know, people live in their fantasy worlds. But here's the best thing a father can do. If he knows that this boy is a cheat, get the girl in the car, take her where he knows that the boy cheats, and then show it to her. Dua, look at that. Look where he's going right now. Whose hand is he holding? Must be his sister, Stati. Then why is he hugging her? That's what brothers do, Stati. Then why is he kissing her now? Stati. But with a prejudiced mind, you see everything the way you want to see. But if you can somehow come out of it, and if the father can give you enough and convincing arguments, then you realize, I see, I'm being cheated on. At that point, it's easier to break that relationship up. In fact, you don't need to do anything. The relationship is well and truly broken. Remember last week I told you, don't let go of anything you're not prepared to. You remember, last week I shared this with you. Don't let go of anything you're not prepared to. In the same token, ladies and gentlemen, by the same token, to let go of anything, the best thing to do is to help you to realize the truth about it. That is what a father should do. Help the daughter, help the son, help the boy, help the child realize the truth about something. So if you're trying to break up a relationship that your child is in and you have good reasons for it, give them those reasons. Help them see the truth. Help them realize the truth. And once they have realized the truth, that relationship does not have much life left in it. But if you try to punish them or ban them from doing stuff, right, it's just going to keep getting worse, I tell you. What feels better than to do something you're not supposed to? Do you remember your younger years? Father used to say, mother used to say, Pada, no matter what you do, don't look at that. Don't read that book. Don't check in that drawer. Don't walk into that room. From the moment that you hear these words, what is the one thing you want to do? To do exactly that, right? See? Don't go onto that website. Which website do you want to go onto first? That website onto which you are not supposed to go. That's the way the mind works. You know, we need to understand how the mind works. We can't just be parents now. We have to be smart parents. A smart parent is someone who understands the mind of the child. Put the child to a side and understand that this is a mind. You know, I wish I could say this to all parents in this country, in this world, because otherwise, with no understanding of this, both parents and children suffer. Parents suffer because they have to punish children and they don't enjoy punishing children. Of course they don't. If they love their child, they don't like to punish the child. And the children suffer because they are being punished. When actually, the real medicine, the real remedy, the real strategy is in sharing the truth. That's why I said, you know, I have the easiest job in the world, and that is to speak the truth. But where the truth does not surface, everyone suffers. Always the case. Wherever there's a lie, someone suffers. Wherever there's falsehood, someone suffers. You know, I'm speaking general truths here. You can apply them into your own life situations and see whether these things actually hold water. So last week there was a question. Isn't ignorance bliss? Someone had asked. Pleasure is bliss, yes, until you realize the true nature of pleasure. Simple example. If this is, imagine when you were born, okay, someone decided to play a prank on you. So what they did was they bent your little finger all the way back, as well, as far as it could go without snapping, and then they tied it to something. Right? Tied it to the rest of your hand. Just imagine that's how you've always known your hand to be. And one day they cut the piece of string, so they tied it with a piece of string and then they let go. In that moment you will experience something similar to Nibbana. Because you will experience a pleasure that you'd never had, because you have always been in pain. That relief from pain, ladies and gentlemen, is what pleasure is. When you realize that pleasure is purely and merely relief from vexation, relief from pain, you begin to fall out of love with pleasure. That is what I want to happen. I'm not trying to stop pleasure altogether, because that will happen over time. In fact, if you don't experience any pleasure at all, then your job here is done. Thank you for coming. You have all become arahants. It is only an arahant who doesn't experience any pleasure at all. So don't you be worried. Now there are some who are really worried about listening to the Dhamma sermons. Some really get, you know, really get worried about it. They say, Swaminathan, if I start listening to the sermons, what if I have to let, you know, I stop feeling the pleasure that I have always gotten used to and the pleasure that I have experienced in my life. You know, I eat nice food, I go to nice places, I be with my friends, I enjoy the things I do and I experience a lot of pleasure out of it. If I start listening to these sermons, you know, then I'm not going to experience the pleasure that I'm used to getting from all these things. What can I say in return to that? What a pity is all I have to say. They say this because they don't understand what pleasure truly is. It's like going out with a cheat. Or it's like living with cancer, not knowing you have it. I have personally, and you may have, I'm sure, in your life, met people who don't want to go for a checkup just in case they find out there's something wrong with them. Tell me you've not had the good fortune of coming across people like that. You know, someone's there just coughing up biscuits and cakes and puddings and all sorts and ice cream, right? All these fatty things and sugary foods, and you tell them, dude, you know, at this rate, you're not going to last another 10 years. You'd better go get yourself checked. No, 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 I don't do that. What if the doctor says I've got diabetes? So it's the doctor's fault. So until the doctor said you got diabetes, you had no diabetes? I'm telling you, people think like this. Can you believe it? Because they like to live in ignorance. Ignorance is blissful. For as long as I'm ignorant, I can just keep on shoving things down my throat. What do you think about people like that? Would you say they are intelligent? Would you say they are wise? Or would you say they are just utterly foolish? They're doing harm to themselves. They just don't want to know the harm it does to them. What do you think about people like that? Honestly, honestly, what do you think about people who do like that? Or at least, let's not say the people who do like that. What do you think about doing like that? If ever you feel to do like that, you know, what might you tell yourself? Next time you walk out, you're not going to put a hat on your head, are you? You're just going to put two horns on your head. That would be a better fit. Because it would be very foolish. If there are dire consequences of you out of your actions, don't you want to know them now? Is it not better sooner rather than later? You know, imagine there was a bottle at home, a bottle of, that contained some liquid, and you always thought that there was orange juice. You like orange juice. You like the taste of orange juice, so you take a sip of it every once in a while. You walk up to it, you drink it, you put it back in the fridge. Right? And then one day, someone comes along and says, what are you doing? I'm having some orange juice, you say. Dude, that's medicine. That's the medicine that dad takes because he can't go to the toilet. That's medicine that he takes. Why are you drinking that? And you said, I didn't realize. It says orange juice. Well, yeah, that day when he brought the medicine, there was no bottle to put it in, so we put it in the orange juice bottle. What would you say to this person who tells you that then? You'd say, why did you do that? Why did you not tell me before? Why did you not tell me earlier about this? I was fooled. Who here likes to be fooled? Put your hand up if you wish to be fooled, if you wish to be tricked. How many times have you caught yourself telling people, why did you lie to me? Why did you cheat on me? Why did you pull a fast one on me? How many times in your life have you caught people saying that to you? You tricked me. I hate you for that. You've heard people say that. You know you're being tricked all the time. Whenever you think that pleasure comes to you from the outside world, from the objects that you associate with, from the people that you associate with, or the events or the circumstances, the situations that you come across, you are being tricked. I need you to first of all fall out of love with that pleasure. The pleasure will stop eventually. It'll stop when it stops. So, you know, don't determine the degree to which you have understood these sermons by measuring or by checking yourself at home, wherever you're around, by, you know, whether you experience pleasure or not. Here's what I want you to do to check whether you have understood the sermon. When you experience pleasure, do you see it with mindful awareness? Being mindful of the pleasure, are you aware of the source of pleasure? Do you understand that pleasure is only a beast in disguise? Do you see that? If you are, you have understood the sermon. But when you experience pleasure, you don't see that side. You want more pleasure. You want more pleasure. You seek more pleasure. You invite pleasure. You wish to have more pleasure. You haven't understood the talk. You haven't got the gist of the sermon. But when you experience pleasure, you're not wishing for more. You wish you had less pleasure because you understand that pleasure is only relief from pain. Pleasure is only relief from vexation. Now, if you ask for pleasure, what are you also asking for? Pain. Because it comes as a couple. You can never have pleasure where there is no pain. Physically, I can give you enough and more examples. When you've been sitting down for a long time, what feels good to do? Stand up. When you've been stood up for a long time, what feels good to do? Sit down. When you put your legs out, stretch your legs out for a long time, what feels good to do? Tuck them back in. And when you've done that for some time, what feels good to do? Stretch them out. So which one brings you pleasure? Which posture brings you pleasure? There you go. Whichever posture you're in brings you pain. I mean, just think about it for now. Like, because as we are in the sermon, I can give you an example that you can relate right here and right now. Take a mental note of the posture you're sat in right now. Right? Take a mental note of the posture you're in right now. Why are you in this posture? Because it feels good. It feels comfortable, right? Well, if this is the posture that makes you feel comfortable, stay in this posture for the next couple of hours. And don't move a finger. Deal or no deal? How come you didn't walk into this room and pick the most comfortable posture? Because there is no such posture. Right now you might have your legs tucked up, but you know, in a moment you'll stretch them out. But if you perhaps you've got one leg over the other, in a while you'll switch the legs. And in a while you'll stretch your legs. Right? You keep changing whenever the pain starts building up. So therefore no one posture can bring you pleasure. Therefore there is no posture of pleasure. All there is the pleasure that you experience when you are relieved from pain. This is the simple fact that I want you to get your heads around. Fall out of love with pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, and then from there on, your journey to Nibbana becomes a cinch. Honestly. The Buddha speaks of this. He says, monks, let me tell you this. The biggest hindrance to Nibbana is pleasure. The biggest hindrance to Nibbana is pleasure. Because how do you convince a man that the happiness that he experiences is not happiness in the first place? That is one of the toughest things I have to do on this Dhamma seat, on this Dharmasana. To convince people that the happiness that they're experiencing is not happiness at all. Because how do you teach a man how to be happy if they already think they're happy? You're all awake, aren't you? Yeah? Are you sure? Now just imagine, if I try to tell you, you're all asleep, I'm going to try and wake you up now, would you believe me? Would you? If I told you, right now, you're all asleep, this is just a dream, I'm going to come and try and wake you up now, would you believe me if I told you that? Of course not. Why not? Because you know, and you think, and you believe that you're awake. So if I were to come and tell you, please, ladies and gentlemen, wake up. You'll think I've gone mad. Won't you? In the same vein, ladies and gentlemen, I find myself in this position every day. And I speak especially to a new audience. And I tell them, none of you are happy. I'm going to help you try and become happy. They're like, what do you know, Swami? I am the happiest man alive. A man who enjoys his riches, a man who enjoys sights, sounds, smells, taste and touch. You try and tell them, you know, happiness, someone who's gorging on a delightful meal, on a scrumptious meal. Right? He's at a restaurant eating, you know, all the foods that he's surrounded by it. Surrounded by all the women he can think of, he wants in his life. Surrounded by all the lovely sights, surrounded by all the lovely sounds. And you tell them, none of this is happiness. I live a happier life. And they look at me, I've got nothing. Try and, you know, make an argument out of that. They'll think I've gone mad. In fact, what they'll think is, this guy doesn't have anything, so he's speaking out of spite. That's what they, initially that's what they think, at least. That's the immediate reaction normally. Swami Nuan says, you know, monks, they come and talk about letting go and giving up because they have nothing. Right? And they can't bear to see all the things that we have as lay people, right? So they're always going on about giving up and letting go because they can't bear to see all the good things and the pleasures that we have and enjoy in our lives. People think like that. I have nothing against them. All I have is even more sympathy. Because one of the toughest things to do, as I say, is to convince a man who thinks he's happy that he's not. That's why the Buddha says, pleasure is the greatest hindrance to Nibbana. So what are we trying to do here then? I'm not trying to rid you of pleasure. First of all, I'm trying to help you to understand what pleasure is. In Buddhism, all we try and do is realize. There is nothing to let go. I promise you. I haven't let go of anything. All I did was realize. So much so that one day you will realize that there is nothing to let go because there is nothing you are holding on to. Your very sense of self, the most precious thing to you, your identity, you as a person, one day you will realize that this is only a manifestation. I, although I feel that I am not really. One day when you realize this, you will no longer hold on to that. You will no longer cling to that self. But you can't not do it. You can't do what I am saying until you realize the truth. That is why under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha never let go of anything. What did he do? What Nibbana? Fill in the blank. He realized Nibbana. That's what he did. We say this, don't we? The Buddha realized Nibbana. That is what you need to do. We realize the truth. Realization is something that happens internally, nothing physical. So hold on to everything you have. Take it, whatever you need. As long as you're not snatching it from someone else who's not willing to give it to you. As long as you're not stealing, you're not thieving, take whatever you need and keep it with you. Just realize. So pleasure. Right now you're experiencing pleasure, you're enjoying pleasure. Maybe there are foods that you like to eat because they give you pleasure. I say, carry on. But as you carry on eating them, come along to the sermons and listen to what I have to say. Then you will not give up forcefully, because giving up forcefully is hurtful. It's self-torture. I wish more people would understand this, if nothing else. People think that Buddhism is their enemy. Imagine a child who thinks that the mother is their enemy. The mother who is going to feed them, look after them, care for them, and protect them. Because a mother exists for the child. Yeah? A mother's existence is defined by them having a child. That is why a woman becomes a mother. She becomes a mother, she qualifies to become a mother when she has a child. So her motherness is because of the child. So she lives for her child. Mothers in the room will understand what I'm saying. Fathers in the room will understand what I'm saying. You live for your children. In the same way, folks, Buddhism is for you. It is your friend. In fact, it is your only friend. Don't ever make an enemy out of it. It will become your enemy. Actually, it'll never become your enemy, but you will think it is your enemy if you try and give up things when you're not ready for it. From time to time, I'll always keep reminding you of this. I will do. You know, every few weeks, I'll keep reminding you of this. Because what I don't want you to do is become holier than you are. Just be as holy as you are, not holier than you are. Your holiness should just be to the level of your understanding of the Dhamma. Don't be holier than that. If you're not prepared to do this, don't do this. What is this? Coming into robes. Don't do it until you're ready. Because what is worse than that is coming into robes and then seeking sensual pleasures. Then you're playing with fire. If you come into robes one day and then you want to be with a woman, now you're in a big mess. If you come into robes and then you want to go to a restaurant and enjoy yourself and go places, sightseeing and whatever, now you're in a big mess. Because that is not what the robe is for. This is the flag of the Arahant. We call it the Arahat Daje. The flag of the Arahant. It is a symbol of an Arahant. It is a symbol of realization, not letting go. It's not a symbol of letting go. It's a symbol of realization. A few weeks ago I told you, I'll explain to you what a robe is. It's called the Chivara. You know that, right? It's called the Chivara. Or Siura. Siuvara. A vara is a boon. So great kings in the past, when they would have peasants and subjects who would come and do things for them, right? Maybe sometimes catch a thief, a burglar of the kingdom, right? They would give them a boon. You know, I'll give you 6 acres of land. That is a boon that they get. We as human beings, we are entitled to a boon. Four of them. These four are the four noble truths. We are entitled to that boon. The noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the cause of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. This is the Siu Vara. The four boons. I bear it on my shoulders. I bear it on my shoulders and across myself, and I cover myself with that, because that is what I am. That is my realization. That is what I'm here to do. Realize the Four Noble Truths. This is a symbol of that. Not of letting go. Therefore, I can use anything. But with understanding. This is what a robe is. To bear the Four Noble Truths is the symbol of the robe. So, until you are prepared to bear the Four Noble Truths, one who bears the Four Noble Truths, now this is not... No, I had better not say that. Let me put it this way. I'm not making a remark about myself. Okay? This is not me making a personal remark about myself. But merely I'm making a distinction in the Dhamma. One who bears the Four Noble Truths is a Sotapanna. That is not saying that I am a Sotapanna. By the way, is it forbidden for someone to say they are a Sotapanna? People have various thoughts about this. Is it forbidden for someone to say they are a Sotapanna or they are a Sakrudagami, Anagami, or Arahat? Not so, ladies and gentlemen. It is not forbidden unless you do it for your personal gain. That is forbidden in the code of conduct. So an Arahatan Vahanse is permitted to claim to be an Arahant. That's perfectly fine. But if they do it for their personal gain, I am an Arahant and you shall treat me like one from today onwards. That is forbidden. It is a Parajika offense. You can no longer remain in the Sangha community. But the point I'm trying to make is, I'm not saying that I'm a Sotapanna by any means. What I'm trying to say is, by virtue of the Siwara, right, that is when someone becomes a Sotapanna. Because the becoming of a Sotapanna is the point where they bear the Four Noble Truths. In other words, they understand that true happiness can only come from within. True happiness does not come from the outside. And not just an understanding so that they can explain something. That's why you can't listen to my speech and gauge whether I'm a Sotapanna or not. That's not something you can do. Because I can give a good talk. Anyone can give a good talk. Talking the talk is one, but walking the walk is another, isn't it? So don't gauge what attainments I may or may not have attained to by listening to what I say. That is my personal achievements and that is my personal journey. And the same applies for you as well. It is not my duty or my task to gauge whether you have become a Sotapanna or an Anagami or an Arahat. You know, that is a very personal and private matter. If you have a teacher, a personal teacher, you can share with them and check with them in case you need to. But besides that, it's not something you put on a billboard or put on a newspaper article. Or, you know, it's not something you advertise to the world. Because what is the purpose of doing so? But there have been plenty of occasions in the past Where the great arahants of the past, you know, they would go and say, I have become an arahant, I have attained to the state of anagami, I have become a sotapanna. They say that to convince people that the path is pure, that it is possible to make to reach these attainments. It is possible to convince other people to walk the same path. You know, when the Buddha attained Buddhahood, what is the first thing he said? I have become a Buddha. I have attained realization. That was an inspiration to others. Just as I have, so can you. So there may be an arahant who will share his story. There may be an arahant who will say that I have become an arahant. But what they're doing is they're encouraging you. They're inspiring you to walk the same path so that you can all attain the same state, the same fruits. For that purpose, it's perfectly fine. So the safest thing to do is for us not to gauge whether when someone says they're an arahant or not, you know, it's not for us to gauge whether they're making it up or whether they have actually attained that state. Let's just let that go. If someone says they're an arahant, the best thing to do is accept that they're an arahant and then treat them like one. Make the offerings as best as you can, because offer in your mind you're offering to an arahant, a sasana, see? Make the offering in your mind because you earn merits out of it. But if they're making personal gains out of it, that is not your loss, it's their loss. They're playing with fire, not you. If I come up here and say, I have become an arahant, now you better come and make all your offerings to me. You will earn tremendous amounts of merits because in your mind you are making those offerings to an arahant. But if I have just made up that lie for my personal gain, every time you make an offering to me, I'm just messing with the wrong stuff. I'm drilling myself down to the four great hells. That is my doing. What I do, I take with me. What you do, you take with yourself. That's the way the world works. Coming back to pleasure. I need you to fall out of love with pleasure. Ask yourself whether you have fallen out of love with pleasure. So those five instances where you experienced over the past week, ladies and gentlemen, when you experienced those moments, did you take a moment to analyze how you experienced that? What was the origin of that? When you, for example, have something pleasurable to eat and we call it tasty, something's delicious, something's scrumptious, in those moments, were you convinced that this is simply relief from vexation? I need you to do this part. I'll give you the talk, but I need you to do the walk at home. You and I, we have to do this together. So there's a bit of homework always. Remember Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. All three are essential components of your salvation. Buddha is the destination. Dhamma is what I give you. What about Sangha? Is that me? Where is Sangha? Not Sangha. Sangha. Where is Sangha? It's within you. It's your practice that is Sangha. So your practice is contemplation on reality. Contemplation on pleasure. Contemplation on beauty. When you see beauty, ask yourself. So say for example today you're walking along this road. You see a pretty girl. You see someone good looking, a handsome guy. And you think, nice. Looks nice. Now ask yourself the question. I see beauty. What is the origin of that beauty? Ask yourself that question. Is beauty in the figure? Is beauty in their shape? Is beauty in their color? Is beauty in their hair? Where is that beauty? Is it all the pieces together? Is that when I see beauty? Ask yourself this question. If I see this as beauty, why doesn't everyone see it as beauty? And if I see this as beauty, then just keep staring at it forever and ever and ever, will I still experience the same amount of pleasure? And you know this is not true. One very convincing argument of this is, try eating the same thing, even no matter how much you like it, keep on eating it, then there comes a point where you say, that's enough, right? You get fed up of it. So that is the beauty of taste, which we call taste, that we call tasty. But there is also the beauty of sight, which we call, well, that word is beautiful. There's the beauty of the ear, which we call melodious. There's the beauty of smell, we call that fragrant. But all these are sensations which are experienced when you are freed from vexation. I need you to come to this thinking. So, shall we meditate for a few minutes? Would you like to do that? right here, right now? Forgot to ask you to bring your meditation mattress or your meditation cushions. How can we meditate without the meditation cushions, Swami Nuhansa? I got it down from Australia just for my meditation. And you need the candles, right? And it has to be your meditation room, right? Yes? I don't know that kind of meditation. The meditation that we speak of is contemplation. Contemplation on the truth. If you have realized the truth, now it's time to apply that truth in everyday life. In everyday life, ladies and gentlemen, that's when you're going to do your meditation. So, I want you to do a meditation for a few minutes. Here's what I want you to do now. Right? If you do it here, I know at least that you've done it. Whereas when I give you homework, because I only check your homework virtually, I don't know whether you've actually done it or not, or maybe you've forgotten, or maybe the week was too busy and it, you know, it just slipped out of your mind. But while you're here, I can get you to do what I want you to do. Right? So for the next few minutes, here's what I want you to do. Take one example of something that has brought you pleasure or that generally brings you pleasure. Now, think of something. It could be anything. I'll give you some examples. If you've already got one in mind, then stick with that. If not, I'll give you some examples. It could be something that you like to see. Maybe there's a place that you like to go everywhere. Maybe it's your backyard. Maybe it's your flower bed. It brings you such pleasure, such delight looking at it, watching it. Maybe it's a person that you like to look at. Then maybe it's their figure, maybe it's their complexion, maybe it's their hair. Maybe it's your arrangement at home, maybe the way you've laid out your room. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's, there's a candle at home. They're very, you know, it's very spectacular. Maybe there's an aquarium, a little aquarium at home. And you like looking at it. You can spend hours looking at it. Just staring at it. Whatever it might be. Or maybe it's a smell that you really like. Maybe your perfume, the bottle of perfume that you have at home, that you really enjoy that, right? Or maybe it's something, some music that you like to listen to. Think of something. Maybe something you like to eat because you love its taste. Think of something. Have you all got something in mind? It can be numerous and it can be various for all of you. It doesn't have to be the same thing for everybody, so obviously, because your lives are all different. This is the lab of life that I'm going to walk you into. Right. Now, whatever you've thought of, you have associated that object with pleasure, haven't you? That's why you like to associate with it. Yes? So, if you take, for instance, a flower, you like to look at them because they're beautiful. This is really simple stuff. This is not rocket science. But until the Buddha shows this to us, we are blind to it. Because we are all happy, that's why. We are all happy, so it's very difficult to make us actually happy. Really happy. Right. So whatever object you have in your mind, you associate that with pleasure. Now, you recall from what we've learned over the past few weeks, that seeing is a process. Do you remember that lesson? Any new faces today? Any others? Oh, we have a few, right? Very quickly, I'm going to go through that. I mean, it'll help those the regulars as well, so that you know what to contemplate on, right? So ever so quickly, I'll take a simple example. This is the eye looking at an object. So I've taken the object as a flower. So there's the eye looking at an object. So what I'm trying to convince you here, or what I'm trying to explain to you here, is that seeing is a process. And most of you will already know this stuff, but I'm just going over it just to make sure that we are on the same page. There's the optic nerve that leads out of the eye, that takes you to the brain. Okay? And then through some mechanism, the brain creates what we call a rupa-rupa. Okay, and you know, you'll have heard and learned perhaps, you know, from some of your readings in Buddhist philosophy, rupa rupa, shabda rupa, gandha rupa, rasa rupa, sparsha rupa, dhamma rupa. So sight objects, smell objects, taste objects, sound objects, and touch objects and mental objects. These are the objects which then the mind has something to do with. Right? Because the mind always needs an object. So this object has now been created. So this is the object now, it goes to the back of the brain and now it drops a sight object. This is a sight object. Have you seen the flower by this point? Think carefully before you answer. Have you seen the flower? Have you actually seen it? Have you seen the flower by this point? Because up to this point, we are talking about a current, an electrical current. Can you see electrical currents? Certainly not. Here you have light rays. These are light rays. Falls on the retina. And from there on it's an electrical current. So you can't have seen it yet. Yeah, I'm talking about seen. You're seeing me around. You can see me. So seeing is a process. But seeing hasn't happened yet. The process is not complete yet. Because at this point it's just a current. This is all it is. In fact, you can hold it to a voltmeter and it will tell you what the voltage is. It's just a current. Now we have a sight object. The sight object is now dropped on what we call the mind faculty. And you have a citta. So I've always used a sine curve to represent a citta because we're talking about a rising and a passing away. Actually, let me not draw it this way, I'll draw it this way. So this sight object was just dropped on the mind base. So say it's us here. And you have a citta. This citta, this thing, right, it has no shape. So this is particularly to help the newcomers, but also just as a reminder for our regulars. This citta, this is a representation of five things that have just happened as a result of this sight object being dropped on the mind base. And what are those five things? Receiving, registering, recognizing, responding, and perceiving. Right? So unless and until these five things have happened, you cannot say you have seen it. In the same way, you cannot say you have heard it. Because actually, what you are seeing is not the object. What you are seeing is a perception. Seeing itself is a perception. Now, this is a very abstract concept to try and get across, but I'll keep trying until the penny drops. When you see things, you think you're actually seeing the object. And you can be forgiven for thinking so because remove the object and you can no longer see it. So you think you're actually seeing the object. But science has helped us so far to understand that from the back of the eye to the brain, we're actually talking about an electrical current. So at that point, there's no longer an object, is there? If it was the actual object you were seeing, then a piece of that object would have to continue down the eye through the nerve and to the back of the brain, right? If it is the actual object you were seeing, the more you see it, what should happen to the object? It should begin to disappear. Because if you're actually seeing the object, if you're actually seeing the object, I know I just keep on saying the same thing. And I think in my mind, the more times I say it, the more it will be clear to you. I feel like I'm passing the intended idea about it by just keep on saying it again and again and again. But I know it's just futile. But I'll keep trying anyhow. The actual seeing of the object If it involves the object, or rather, if it is the object that we see, the more times we see it, the object should actually disappear. Let me draw a parallel so you understand this. When we eat something, say eating a biscuit, you actually eat the biscuit. How do we know this? Because every bite you take, the biscuit eventually disappears. So now you can be convinced you are actually eating the biscuit. But it's not the object that you are seeing. Because if you are seeing the object, the more you keep looking at it, the object should disappear. But it doesn't happen. So then therefore, it's not the object you are seeing. It is a representation of that object. It's a manifestation of that object. Okay, so I hope you've got that. Now the object is dropped on the mind base, and this is a representation, a symbolic representation of five events that have just taken place. That is Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana, which were the same five that you said earlier in English: receiving, registering, recognizing, responding and perceiving. When perceiving has happened, you can say, I have seen the object, because ultimately the seeing of an object is actually a perception. I perceive objects would be a better way to say, I see objects. I perceive objects. So there are seeing perceptions, there are smelling perceptions, there are tasting perceptions, there are hearing perceptions, and there are feeling perceptions, and there are thinking perceptions. They're all perceptions. They're all perceptions. Although we simply say, I see things, what's really happening is, you're perceiving things. That's why we have different perceptions of things. We have different perceptions of things, right? So, now this object has been perceived. The flower has been perceived and the chitta arises and passes away. Before it arises, there is no way that the object can be seen. During its lifetime, you see the object, and after it passes away, now again the object has just disappeared. The object is there, but you're not seeing it. As soon as the next chitta starts and the object is still in front of your eye, you're seeing the same object again. Okay, that much we know. Now, but our meditation has to involve beauty. That is what we're trying to do now. So how does beauty happen? Last week we talked about the origins of beauty. I explained to you that beauty is the experience of the mind relieving itself from vexation when it concerns sight objects. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a sight object. If this faculty were the nose, I would be saying this would be a smell object. If this faculty were the tongue, I would be referring to this as a taste object. But for this example, I'm referring to this as a sight object, because it is the eye that is the sense door that's bringing in a stimulus which has been converted to an electrical impulse that has been taken to the brain. And now the brain has, because by virtue of the fact of where it was dropped on the brain, I'll say that again. By virtue of the fact of where it was dropped on the brain, if I were to unplug this and plug it to the taste center and put a flower in front of the eye, how do you think you will perceive it? You think you'll see it? No. You will taste something. Sometimes, you know, if you were to rewire your brain, and the electrical impulse would be taken to your taste center, I put something in front of your eye and you go, that tastes a bit sweet actually. I mean, honestly, that is how it would work. I'm not kidding. This might sound like science fiction, but well and truly, it is so. That is why these days, you know, science has developed various devices which you can use to actually give you the sense of taste, without actually putting anything on your tongue. Without actually putting any strawberry on your tongue, you can sense strawberry. And there are devices that people use now, you know, for the blind. People are being given the ability to see. Not the same way that you and I see, but they put a device over their heads and it sends electrical impulses. Provided it's taken to the right center of your brain, it's like when someone whacks you with something on the back of your head, what do you see? You see light, right? So, then to see light or to see something, must an object be put in front of your eye? I'll ask the question again. For you to see something, must an object be put in front of your eye? Must it? No. What is required then? Stimulation. Absolutely. If the right part of your brain is stimulated, then the brain will take on the responsibility of producing a sight object and putting it on the mind base. That is what's happening. So we have first-hand experience of this, thankfully. So I can use that to explain the gist of my talk today. But we are talking about beauty, something that goes beyond the normal dealings with the mind. At this point, the mind wishes to see a flower because the mind believes that that a flower is beautiful. Because I asked you to think of something that you find pleasurable. These are all based in views. I talked about views to you last week, and I have a video to show you in just a moment. I'll come to that as soon as we've done your meditation. If you do your meditation, I'll give you a treat. See, I'm good like that. So, I remember in my school days, you know, we would always wait until the end of the class. If we were good in class, the teacher showed us a cartoon or a video of some sort, right? So if you're good in class, I'll show you the video. So when the mind wishes to see something that it thinks is beautiful, is it beautiful? I mean, if it is beautiful, it should be beautiful to everyone. But it's not. That's why if I asked you or took a survey around the room, not all of you have the same answer. Right? Some will say, I thought of a chocolate Swaminathan. Others will say, I thought of pasta. Others will say, I thought of Leonardo da Vinci and one of his drawings. And someone will say, I thought of the last time I went on a trip. I thought of my boyfriend. I thought of my girlfriend. Others will say, right? Thankfully, no one finds your boyfriend as good looking as you do. See, these are blessings in disguise, don't you think so? Just imagine if everyone thought your wife was so beautiful. Although you'd like to think that everyone thinks my wife is so beautiful, fortunately not everyone does. Because if they did, you'd have a tough time keeping her to yourself. So fortunately, beauty lies in the mind of the beholder. That's why although you find her so attractive, you find him so attractive, thankfully not everyone does. Again, even more evidence to convince you that beauty is not in the object. So don't be fooled. It's too late for that, Swami Nuhans, I hear you say. Right, so you have the object, and now you understand how beauty works. It's simply relief from vexation. I want you to take a few minutes to contemplate on this process. There are two processes in play here, folks. One process is the seeing process. Seeing process has nothing to do with beauty. That's why once you become an arahant, the seeing process will still happen. But what will not happen is the beauty process. Because there is no beast. And what is that beast? Vexation. Vexation is only driven or is rooted in ignorance and attachment. Where ignorance prevails, attachment prevails. Where attachment prevails, vexation is there. Vexation manifests. Where vexation is there, your mind goes into, it gets crushed like this. I'm trying to give you a visual representation of what happens to the mind. It almost gets crushed. Or you could think of much pressure that's building up in it. And then you give it a moment of relief. That vent of relief is given to the mind. And at that point, that tension, that stress, that pain, it is relieved. That is what you experience as pleasure. Very similar to this. Right? Now let's take a few minutes while we set the video up. I want you to take a few minutes and to think of the object that you have in your mind and try and walk through the process of one, seeing or smelling or tasting as per your example, and two, think about how that brought you pleasure. What is the pleasure process versus what is the seeing process, the sensing process? So again, there are two processes here I want you to think about. First of all, I want you to think of the sensing process. Do you understand the sensing process? The process that is to do with the senses. Seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, right, or thinking. Take a simple one. Seeing, smelling, tasting, taste, you know, these are simple ones to deal with initially. Whereas thinking, you know, that can take a little bit of practice. And secondly, have a think about how that brings you pleasure. Is it the object that has the pleasure? Or is it the mind when it's in the state of wanting it, when it's in the state of urging, in a great state of urge, it's looking for that experience, and then it releases itself from that experience, it experiences this sense of pleasure. So take a few moments to think about that while we get the video set up.
Can you come back from your fourth jhana now, please?
I'm just jesting.
Did you take a moment to contemplate whatever that object was?
Hopefully, you focus your attention on two processes, the two processes I have put down on the board here. There's the top process, which is the object coming into contact with the sense door. Yeah? So as I give out the principle, you go back and look through your experience. So there's the object that came into contact with the sense door, and then through a lengthy process, which I have just summarized into one arrow here, which includes the brain, the optic nerve, or the auditory nerve, or whatever, sensory nervous systems, and so on. You have the receiving, registering, responding, recognizing, and the perceiving process. And as soon as it's come to this point, perception, you have now either seen, heard, smelled, tasted, or felt, or thought. These are the six things that can happen, and they happen as a natural process. It happens to every mind that exists. So from an arahant to a prutakjana, this process runs for everybody. Fair and square? Then here's the next process. This is the defilement process. This is a natural process, and this is a defilement process. This is the process that is responsible for both pleasure and pain. This process is perfectly harmless. It's very natural. The purpose of our exercise here, the purpose of our Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha here, is to get to this point by eradicating this. Of course, the end result seems like it's pleasure. But the problem is that pleasure only comes from the relief from vexation. And that vexation was built up through attachment. And that attachment comes from ignorance. I'll put a question mark up there. Just to prompt you to find the answer to this question, ignorance of what? Because when we say ignorance, it has to come with something, right? Because ignorance is an attribute. Ignorance of what? What do you think? Ignorance of all this. That is why I'm sharing this with you. It is your ignorance that seeing is a process, and that pleasure is the product of a separate, a very different process. It is your ignorance of that that makes you think that pleasure comes from the sight that you see. But once you realize, through your understanding of the Dhamma, that pleasure is purely relief from vexation, and that vexation came from attachment, and that attachment came from your belief, wrong thinking, wrong view, that pleasure is in the object, you go through this process. So actually, ignorance is the ignorance of ignorance. If you figure out what ignorance is, now you really know what ignorance is. I know that sounds like a riddle. But well and truly, ignorance is the ignorance of ignorance. You know, now you understand what ignorance is, right? We've always been ignorant about various things. You know, what day of the week it is. We've been ignorant for it. At some point in our lives, we were ignorant about it. Someone taught us, you know, Monday to Sunday, these are the 7 days of the week. Until then, we were ignorant. If someone asks you what is the capital of Sri Lanka, there was a point you were ignorant about it and someone taught you this. So there are things about life we are ignorant of. In the same manner, folks, there are things about the mind we are ignorant of, such as beauty is in the flower, tasty is in the cake, fragrance is in the perfume. I'm talking about the pleasurable fragrance, it's in the perfume. Right? When we think that these objects
inherently have these pleasurable sensations that we experience, we think that the biscuit we eat brings us that tastiness. We think that the sight we look at brings us the pleasure. So we think that it's in the object. Therefore, what will we do? We'd like to surround ourselves with those objects. We like to build our lives around with those objects. We like to have as many of those objects with us. Isn't that what life is all about? What is the story of your life? Going around looking for the things that you think bring you pleasure and then trying to surround yourself with all those things. Now you have a good question to ask. So then why has Swami Mohan said let go of all those things? Did I let go or did I realize? That's the point. Once you realize that pleasure or happiness is not in the object, why have the object in the first place? Why go after the object if it's not in it? Once you realize that tastiness is not in the cake, why go for cake? I know sometimes, you know, you're probably wondering, why does Swami Mohan take all this food in the same alms bowl? Isn't that not like disgusting? He's got cake in there, he's got juice in there, he's got yogurt in there, he's got rice in there, and curry in there, and sandwiches in there. When he exits the monastery, I wonder how he eats this. Your concern is only until it passes your mouth, right? Once it gets into the sack, it's all there anyway, together. So you see, the problem you have is, you struggle, when these two tastes come together, you don't like that. When say, cake taste comes with, the taste of, potatoes, potato curry and cake. Together, you feel that's disgusting. Because you like to experience those tastes differently. Why? Because you think, pleasurable taste is in the taste, is in the potato, is in the cake. So therefore, I want to eat my cake separately. I want to eat my potatoes separately. That is when I get to experience the taste that is in the cake and in the potato. But once you begin to realize that this pleasurable taste is neither in potato nor in cake, then why does it matter whether you eat it together or separately? And then you realize that eating is a thing that we do to sate our hunger, not to satisfy our tongues. Because really, it is not this tongue that you try to satisfy in the first place. The tongue is simply a sense door. It is the mind that you try to satisfy by using the tongue. In other words, actually abusing the tongue. Once you tame the mind, once the mind realizes the truth, now the mind no longer wishes to abuse the tongue. The tongue is merely there as a device, as an instrument that allows you to taste objects or food. That's it. So you know that something's too bitter and it shouldn't be going down your throat. That we can use the tongue for. Why are prescription drugs bitter? They are made to be bitter so that we don't take them by mistake, especially young children. That is by design. That's why drugs which are not prescription drugs, you know, they don't taste so bitter. You can take them, no problem. So they are made bitter by design. Because we have an innate reaction to reject things that are bitter. So which taste do you think Swami Mohan likes better? Savory or sweet or sour? If you want to please me, what food item do you think you can give me? Pudding? Cheesecake? Yum, yum, yum. We have gone beyond that. I am not a slave to my taste buds. In fact, through my understanding of this, I have been able to free myself from this urge, from this drive, from this slavery to the ignorance of taste, ignorance of deliciousness. Because today we realize that this pleasurable feeling of taste only comes out of ignorance. That ignorance is the thinking that tastiness exists in the object. Because the moment you think something is there, you want it.
there is that wanting that causes your mind to go like that. It goes into a state of void. It goes into a vacuum. It goes into unsatisfactoriness, unfulfillment. And then it's looking for a release. It's looking for relief. And once you give the object, it is released from that. But the object does not have pleasure in it. What it was simply the object. And that relief you experience as pleasure. Does that make sense to you? We'll talk about this more in future talks. But at least if the concept has now started to take seed in your mind, then you can contemplate on your experiences in the future. So once again, do you think Buddhism is about letting go? Do you? No, not at all. That's why I say don't let go of anything you're not prepared to let go. So get it into your heads that Buddhism is not about letting go. It's purely realization. That is why Buddhist teaching is for the wise. You need the faculty of wisdom to be able to realize things. A fool cannot do that. A wise man can. That is why a fool can never attain Nibbana, because they can't realize. They don't have the wisdom. They don't have what it takes to realize things. But even a fool can let go of things. Letting go is such an easy thing to do. Don't undermine Buddhism and bring it to the same level of letting go. That is such an insult on the Buddha. If you were to say that Buddhism is about letting go, that's the biggest insult that you can make to the Buddha. The Buddha never let go of anything. He did as the Prince Siddhartha. When he renunciated his lay life, yes, he let go. Because he had no understanding. He was just a pratajana. He was a lay person. So he let go of those things, and it would have been very painful for him. Plenty of times he looked back at his castle, at his palace, at his young prince, and wondering, do I, don't I? Do I, don't I? But on his behalf as well as ours, he let go, and that was very painful. But then under the Bodhi tree, he realized the truth. And at that point, he realized that there was nothing to let go. That is where I'm trying to get you, one step at a time. This is one step in the right direction. Right, so as you've been all so good, I'm going to show you this video. This video is just to convince you of one fact. So I have to tell you what this video is for. This video is to help you understand that the mind can be fooled. I want you to be convinced of this. Because you might say, nobody can fool me. The mind can easily be fooled. First, you have to realize that. The mind can be fooled. It is because the mind is fooled, the mind is ignorant. Right, so we've already learned that ignorance is something that happens in the mind when it doesn't understand the truth. But I'm just going to give you some, these are just some short commercials that we have managed to obtain from the internet. That just, they're just some funny stories. So just a bit of drama. It's just easy watching. Enjoy yourself as you watch it. But it's just to convince you of one fact though. This is not just entertainment. This is rather edutainment. So I want to educate and entertain at the same time, hopefully. But as you watch them, these video clips, please take a moment to think about why it is that the people in these videos are fooled. It is because the mind can be fooled. The mind can be tricked. And if that is so, then can't this mind be fooled the same? Is the question I want you to leave with today. So you remember, I related that first clip last week. Yeah? So what happened there? This man was cooking something for his wife, and then the cat jumped on the stove, and when it jumped, then the stew or whatever he was cooking fell on the floor, right? And then he held the cat in one hand, knife in the other. The wife walks in and thinks that the man has just tried to kill the cat. So who's fooled there? The wife has been tricked. Right? Not intentionally, but so again, evidence that the mind can be tricked. Now in this episode, what you're seeing is the wife comes and tells the husband, I don't hate your mother. I don't know whether you heard the dialogue, that's why I'm repeating it to you. She says, I don't hate your mother. So they must be having some kind of argument in the family, as they do. Yes? So she says, I don't hate the mother, and then let's see what happens next.
I don't hate your mother. Morning, Bev.
Did you catch that? What was she doing? She was just fluffing up the pillow, right, helping the mother be comfortable. And then when she had her pillow in her hand, and the husband walks in, what does he think she's trying to do? Smother her. So again, he was fooled. Because the mind can be fooled. These are all drushti. What was the drushti that the husband was in earlier? They must have had an argument that that he must be believing right now that the wife doesn't like his mother. So then, with that view, he approaches the situation. So with that view, as he approaches the situation, he reads everything from that perspective. It's the same thing happening here. With that perspective, you're reading the world. So your world view is predetermined. So with that perspective, as he reads the world, he thinks that now the wife is actually trying to murder his mother. When in fact, the wife is only trying to do what is right by her. Make sense? All right, next one, please.
There's a fractured fibula, given mouth, etc. So I could be able to go home tomorrow.
Daddy's going to be so excited.
That killed him.
What did you see there? So the mother and girl, they come to see their poor father who's not well. They come to the hospital looking to greet him and talk to him. And as they walk into the ward, these two doctors, they have come for a regular inspection. And they have with them, what do you call them? Resuscitator, what is it? Resuscitator? Yes. But there's a fly. An annoying, pesky fly. So what the doctor does is it electrocutes the fly. Which does what to the fly? It kills it. So as the couple, the mother and daughter walk into the room, this guy says, that killed him. With the electrocutor in his hands. Making the daughter think what? That they've just killed the father. See? Drishti. They've judged the whole situation just depending on, based on one event. See how quickly the mind can be tricked. And the consequences that can come out of it, that could be enough to shock the wife and the daughter. So we don't know what happened after that. There must have been some explanation that would have had to follow. But again, an example of how the mind can be tricked. Right, next one, please.
Hello. How much are they asking?
Well, that's a lot of money for a deck.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but you're getting robbed. Did you hear me? You're getting robbed.
Ow! Stop!
So what did you see there? So someone's on the phone walking into the store and they're trying to convince someone on the other end of the line that paying that much money for something is like getting robbed. Yeah, so this guy's on the phone explaining this to in the store and he stood in front of the cashier. So that's one of the worst things you can be saying when you're stood in front of a cashier. Don't try to convince someone that they're paying too much for something, especially by using those words. Because the cashier now thinks that he's actually here to rob the guy. So what does he do? He retaliates. complete misjudgment of the situation based on views. This is drushti. So are you not convinced enough by this point that drushti can completely turn your life upside down? See, that's what that is doing to you. This is what ignorance, which is your drushti, is doing to you. You have the view, ladies and gentlemen, that beauty is in the object. And that is why you are suffering. That is why you need them in your life. And that is why when you experience them, you sense this pleasure, which is the relief that you get when you actually acquire them in the end. Let's try the next one.
Oh. Look at the cute dog.
It's my favorite one. Need I say more? How you can completely misjudge a situation? I don't need to spell that out to you, right? It was pretty obvious what was going on there. Is it not the same thing that's happening here? Thank you. All based in ignorance. Now, each of the individuals who were observing those incidents, now you understand what's going on because you know the whole story. Right? So, in fact, you feel sorry for the guy who had to pick up that brownie or something and he was trying to eat it. And the embarrassment that he must have felt when everyone, when the, you know, the mother and the daughter were looking at him, thinking, what a pervert this guy is. And a weirdo. You must have felt sympathy towards this guy. But that's because you understand the whole situation. So when you understand the whole situation, you have sympathy for those who don't. Does that ring a bell? When you understand the whole situation, you have sympathy for those who don't. Yes. If you were there in that last example, right? If you were there in the park, what would you do next? Tell me. What would you have done? You'd have gone up to the girl and the mother, hopefully, and said, "Oh, hold on. Here's what happened. That guy's not eating dog poo. Right? That was actually just a piece of cake or some brownie or something he dropped. It's just the same color and he dropped it behind the dog. So it's wrong for you to think that it was the dog's feces that this guy was eating. It's wrong for you to think that." But the girl doesn't know this because she didn't see the whole picture. So when you don't see the whole picture, and I'm not talking about seeing through your physical eyes, I'm talking about seeing through your mental eye, your wisdom eye. When you don't see the whole picture, you come into wrong conclusions. You misjudge. And look at the predicament it leaves you in. That's why you suffer. See, attachment causes suffering. And when you somehow acquire the object of your attachment, you are relieved from suffering. But you think that this is true relief from suffering. It is not. It's just a plaster over the wound. It's not true relief. It's like scratching a rash. It's not treatment. It just gives you temporary pleasure. It's just temporary relief. In fact, here's the worst part of this, and I'll conclude with that for today. Here's the worst part of this. This is a vicious cycle. How so? Every time you experience pleasure, it goes back to feed the loop. It goes back to feed the loop. And therefore it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is positive feedback. Every time you experience pleasure, you are further convinced that beauty is in the object. And so therefore you try to acquire it even more, and even more, and even more. And where does it stop? Why do you think man cannot be satisfied? Here's the answer. Every time you experience pleasure and you have no understanding of the Dhamma, you think pleasure comes from the object and therefore you keep on digging for it. That's why what makes you happy today will not make you happy tomorrow. You need something more. You need something different. You need variety. Variety is the spice of life. See what has happened to you? Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, the only refuge. Now you think so because I say so, or because you have begun to understand the truth? Now you say, Natti me saranang anyang, Buddho me saranang varang. There is no other refuge other than freeing myself entirely from this misery that the mind creates for itself. Buddha is a state where attachment has been eradicated. Therefore, there is no more vexation. Therefore, there is no longer need for relief from that vexation. That is what Buddha is. Dhamma is what I'm sharing with you right now. The truth. You are ignorant of this truth. You are ignorant to this truth. It is your ignorance of this truth that puts you into this in the first place. Sangha is you understanding this and then practicing it. Like I said, just because you have understood it doesn't mean from today onwards you will stop feeling pleasure. That's not how it's going to work. Because your mind is so used to seeking that pleasure. It's so used to it. It's like learning to ride a bike. The first time you get on it, sure and sure as hell, you're going to fall. But if you keep on at it, one day you will ride it with your arms behind your back. That's why Sangha has to come with practice. That's what we do as Sangha. We practice. I have dedicated my life to this practice. You have dedicated whatever time is available to you. That's why I say the journey I take in a rocket, you come in a bicycle. But at least, that's a journey heading in the right direction. Just think about what you used to do with your lives before Sunday mornings happened. Here's what you used to do. You went in search of pleasure, and every time you experienced pleasure, it was a positive feedback loop, and you were convinced further and further, not of the truth, but a lie. That's why a lie always has to be sustained. It needs to be kept fed, whereas the truth, which brings me back to where I started this talk today, the truth is self-sustaining. You don't need to feed the truth. The truth is self-standing. That's why I have the best job in the world. So, dear ladies and gentlemen, I invite you, wake up. Wake up to the truth. Yes, you're all woken up. You're all awake. I'm not talking about that awake. I'm inviting you to wake up to the truth. See reality. See what's happening to you. Now, if you've understood this, I invite you to do that homework again for this week. Take 5 examples of where you experience pleasure and analyze, self-analyze what's really going on here. Is this really the object bringing me pleasure, or the mind going through this process of ignorance, therefore attachment, therefore vexation, and then going into relief from vexation when you finally acquire that object, and then that brings you this sensation of relief? The sensation of pleasure. The more you begin to realize this, the more you become wise and the less you become ignorant. Once you are totally free of that ignorance, this process can no longer run because it is rooted in ignorance. That's why I say the only way to stop this from happening is to realize this is happening. I'll say that again one last time. The only way to stop this from happening is to realize that it is this that is happening. This is only happening because you don't realize that it is this that is happening. You think, when this happens, I also get pleasure. Not so. Does that make sense to everybody? Thank you. I'll thank you for coming. Okay, let's conclude for today then. Let's take a moment to transfer all the merits we have acquired to all those who deserve it. And just as we are able to walk this path to our salvation, may many more people who are lost in the delusion of ignorance be freed from that delusion. May your hearts fill with compassion towards all sentient beings. Now you realize why I make that trek right from the Arama to here, to get here every Sunday. Not because I need anything from you, but I have something that you need. So may all sentient beings have the merit to one day realize this truth and free themselves from suffering. So with that in mind, let us take a moment to transfer these merits. First and foremost, then, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer this message to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others or inviting others to join them, and may by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to friends of the monastery, our devotees, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who provide for the construction of the monastery to those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who continue to extend their well wishes and their know-how. May they all rejoice in these merits and by the power of these merits, if any, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and teachers, our friends, our acquaintances, our employees, our employers, as well as our teachers and those who have made great efforts on our behalf. May they all rejoice in these merits and by the power of these merits, if any, by the power of these merits, may they all be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas and spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva as well as all the nimas, gods and deities who have committed themselves to preserving and fulfilling the Sambuddha Sasana. May they all rejoice in these merits, and also those who are guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they rejoice in divine power, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, may they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name, our forefathers, our loved ones, our ancestors, those who have shed blood, sweat and tears on our behalf, and it is in their labor today we enjoy the fruits and are able to practice and listen to the Dhamma in bliss and harmony. May they all rejoice in these merits, and with immense gratitude towards them, let us take a moment to transfer these merits to them. Let us also transfer these merits to all those who make great sacrifices to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes the police force as well as the members of the armed forces, as well as those who would have lost their lives in lives in wars, be they friend or foe. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on. May they all rejoice in these merits, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, as well as those who would have gone way out of the way to help us, support us and assist us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them, with an immense sense of gratitude, loving kindness and compassion towards all of them. Let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. If any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Vahanse, or an Arahatiran in Vahanse, in this very life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you all.
Raga ginnen nidatnva Dvesha ginnen nidatnva Moha ginnen nidatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan Sapala Deva Nivan Sapala Deva Nivan Sapala Deva
Tunruvange Suvisi Ananta Maha Guna Belen Siru Loka Siru Sattvevama Nibbana Paramasukhen Sukhita Taravetva Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu.